For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show recorded at the RNIB Talking Book Studios. I'm your host, Red Sale, and this week, to celebrate the publication of Kika and Me, How One Extraordinary Guide Dog Changed My Life, we have an in-depth conversation with Dr. Amit Patel, the other half of a winning team.
Kika's not listening to me, she won't let me use the bathroom. And Becca's like, Amit, you're bigger than her. Just pick her up and lift her out of the way. Just tell her who's boss.
I'm Robert Kirkwood. And to keep Kika happy, I'll be chasing up some other shaggy dog stories in the RNIB library.
Nigel has that very rare quality of drawing attention to him as if by osmosis. He steals every scene he's in.
That's all coming up on today's show. But first,
in recent weeks, we've featured interviews with all five category winners from this year's Costa Book Awards. From these five winners, the judges had to select one title to be crowned overall 2019 Costa Book of the Year. And they picked The Volunteer by Jack Fairweather. I spoke to Jack the morning after the announcement and began by asking him about the awards ceremony.
Well, it was particularly special for me because two of my researchers who spent 2 years in the archives in Auschwitz putting this book together were there. One of them flew in from Poland yesterday, and it was lovely to stand on the podium and, you know, 300 people in the room, the amazing authors who had also been winners in their categories with me, and just to be able to get up and say thank you for your help, and to then dedicate the award to Andre and Zofia, who are the two children of the hero of my book. And it was a very emotional moment for me because for 50 years they hadn't known about what their father had done in Auschwitz. In fact, they'd been told that their father was an enemy of the state. The communist regime tried to hide, destroy his legacy in Auschwitz for reasons we may get to touch upon. But to be able to get up there and share the award with them was really touching. In fact, Andre Vitold, 88-year-old son, gave me a call from Warsaw last night, and he'd heard about the award, which is just is one of the amazing things about the Costa, is just how it reaches so many people. And I got to share the moment with him.
And this is the amazing thing, that a man who actually volunteered in 1940 to go to what even then was a death camp and led resistance there was basically almost erased from history by the Russians, by the supposed allies who were fighting against Nazism, and his story, well, apart from you, would have fallen into obscurity for the rest of time.
It's all the more shocking and in some ways disturbing when you just dwell for a moment on what he did, because it is almost unthinkable. In 1940, he volunteered for Auschwitz. He got himself arrested deliberately so the Nazis would take him to the camp in order to report on German crimes there. And over the next 2.5 years, he built up an underground of almost 1,000 men, and they were assassinating SS officers, sabotaging facilities, and staging some of the most incredible breakouts from, I think, any concentration camp during the war, all in order to get out word of what was happening in the camp. And it's just the story of the most incredible courage, and all the more shocking and surprising when you think that this was Auschwitz. This was the heart of evil of the Nazi empire. And there was this man and this band of men he forged around him who were every day risking their lives in order to try and alert the West to what was happening.
His report actually ended up on the desk of the chief of the RAF, and he was begging the RAF to bomb Auschwitz.
That was Paletsky's first report that he managed to smuggle out of the camp within a few weeks of arriving. And as you said, it was just this very brutal concentration camp. 100 prisoners were dying each week, being beaten to death, shot on starvation rations. Paletsky managed to get out a report via a released prisoner, one of the few times that that happened. And he had the man take an oral message to Warsaw. It was then smuggled across occupied Europe all the way to London, where it reached Charles Portal, the head of the RAF. And these were the words that Paletsky had. And when we found them in the archives a couple of years ago, I just got goosebumps hearing them, because these are the words that Paletsky had his messenger memorized. So it's almost, when you hear them, like he's saying them in the camp in those terrible conditions. He said, "Please, for the love of God, bomb Auschwitz, even if it means killing everyone in it, because what's happening here is so terrible. We have to do everything to try and stop it." And he sent out that message. It reached London in January 1941. It was 2 years before the Holocaust really took full effect in Auschwitz. A million of the camp's victims were still alive. And it's, of course, one of those great might have beens that I get to explore in the book. You know, what would have happened had the Allies intervened at that moment?
It's a chilling what if. And 2 days after the world remembered the liberation of Auschwitz 75 years ago, it's even more poignant.
Well, I think, like anyone who heard the survivors who gathered in Auschwitz on Monday, will have been struck by the poignancy of the moment. There were 200 odd gathered at the gates. This may be the last major commemoration when there are any survivors. One of the things I wanted to do in the book was just meet as many people as I could who had known Paletsky, who had, in some cases, even fought with him. And it was the greatest honor and privilege of my writing career to be able to take down their testimonies and tell their story along with Paletsky's. And I think what I took away from this week's commemoration was we have had the help of survivors to remember what the Nazis did, and soon we won't have their voices, and it's beholden on us as the next generation to work out how we can still remember. And for me, that was what was so incredible about Paletsky's story, because he takes you through the camp. He was there at its beginning. He witnessed the steps by which Auschwitz became a death factory for Europe's Jews, and there's something really important historically about what he did, and I think also something we can all take away, because he was able to resist the Nazis in Auschwitz. Unbelievable bravery. And for me, that was inspiring to think about what I could do in my own life to reach out and engage with others.
I'd never quite appreciated how brutalized the Poles were by all sides before, during and after the Second World War, and how much they'd suffered. Has the book been well received in Poland?
It is really eye-opening. It was for myself and for a lot of listeners to learn that the war didn't really end in 1945 for Poland. They were subjected then to Soviet occupation for decades afterwards, and they were not allowed to commemorate or observe their heroes. And Paletsky's story was one of hundreds hidden away, and that to speak of them would lead to arrest and worse. And so think about how we lionize rightly our heroes who took part in the Battle of Britain, those who landed on the beaches in Normandy. Poland never had the chance to recognize its heroes. And so that's what I tell people who are sort of coming to Polish history. It's like, this is 50 years later than the rest of Europe that these men are being recognized. I came to believe after 5 years following in his footsteps that he is one of the greatest heroes of World War II of any country. And I hope that your listeners, when they hear the story, that they will be inspired like I've been to follow in his footsteps and just enjoy his great courage.
Well, Jack Fairweather, it is a compelling, amazing, moving, astounding story that I think makes one of the best audiobooks I've listened to. Many, many congratulations on winning the 2019 Costa Book of the Year.
Thank you, Red. Thank you so much.
The Volunteer by Jack Fairweather is out now in print and audiobook, narrated by David Rintoul. You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Coming up later, a a pack of Shaggy Dog stories retrieved from the RNIB library. But before that, Dr. Amit Patel is a disability rights campaigner, motivational speaker and accessibility and diversity consultant who's worked as a volunteer for RNIB. To highlight some of the negative reactions that he and his guide dog Kika received on public transport, he fitted Kika with a GoPro. In 2015, a video of an irate commuter rudely asking Amit and Kika to get out of the way went viral. Since then, Amit has worked tirelessly to spread his message of positivity and inclusivity, and it's taken him on quite a journey. His book, Kika and Me, How One Extraordinary Guide Dog Changed My World, was published this week. And I'm delighted to say that both Amit and Kika are here with me in the studio today. Oh, and by the way, if you're wondering what those sounds are in the background, Kika had a good old sniff of her surroundings before settling down and falling asleep. Dr. Amit Patel, welcome to Read On.
Thank you so much.
So a lot of listeners will know your story, but for those who don't, can you tell us a little bit about losing your sight and the early years of getting to terms with it?
Yeah, so I lost my sight due to a hemorrhage in the back of my eyes, and it happened so very quickly that we didn't really have any time to plan. It happened overnight. So life changed dramatically for us. And to be honest with you, getting grips with sight loss was the challenging part. Due to the fact that it went so quickly, I kind of hoped it would come back very quickly, and I think that was what I was holding on to. I think it was that you don't want to admit that you're blind. You know, you're listening to the consultants, even though they were telling me there's not a lot of things they can do, really. But you kind of just hope that someone will find a miracle. It took me a long time to get to grips that I lost my sight. But when I did, I think that's when my journey really began.
Yeah. Your background is medical. You were working for the Red Cross as a trauma doctor. Yet even you were hoping for that medical miracle against the evidence.
Oh, absolutely. With me, it's very much science matters. I'm someone who actually follows the science. Miracles happen. They do happen. And I hoped it would happen to me. But as a doctor, I know what to expect. And my doctor's hat would say, Amit, get used to it now, this is your life. But deep down, I kind of hope that one in a million chance, something might just be out there. I guess it's that whole, do you listen to your doctor? Do you kind of hold on to what you might believe might kind of change your life? But it wasn't to be. And here we are now.
And your shock and grief was compounded by some pretty unpleasant encounters with members of the public, which led you to put a GoPro on your guide dog. It didn't exactly encourage you to go back outdoors after you lost your sight, did it?
No. I think the one thing I never really thought about when I lost my sight was how lonely it is. And I think it's being in your own world by yourself all of the time. I don't have any useful vision at all. I see a blue mist. I have lots of floaters in my eyes. So even standing still, it feels like I'm moving. So I'm kind of having to balance myself. And I also get a lot of pain in my eyes, 24/7. It's like someone rubbing chili powder in them. And we went down the whole pain relief side of things. But because it's just isolated into the eyes, it's very difficult just to treat that. So now it's just a mind over matter. Yeah, I have to deal with that every single day. But it's the fact that when you're on a train or you're out by yourself, you have to think about what you're doing and you have to think ahead of where you're going. And I think people don't realize just how much mental energy you actually need to just do a simple trip. It might look effortless to someone watching, you know, swiping your white cane, walking down the road, you read the tactiles on the pavement, but it's a lot of hard work. But even being on a train and hearing noises around you, I don't put my headphones on because I listen out for the audio announcements, I listen out for all the dangers. So a 5-minute journey in a tube feels like it's half an hour, and it feels like nobody wants to talk to me. I can't talk to anybody else. I don't have an eye contact. I've never ever felt that before in my life. But the one thing that really shocked me was how other people would treat a disabled person. You'd think that when the doors open on a train, that people who see the white cane would give you just a few extra seconds just to step off. Not everybody does. You know, the majority do. But you get those one or two people who want to barge you out the way, want to beat you to an escalator, or just say things like, you shouldn't be on the train at peak time, it's too busy for you. As if being blind means you can't ride a train, or you don't have any work to do, or you just like riding the train for fun. And then it got to a point when I did get Kika, that Kika would stop in the middle of a very busy environment, and she would back herself onto me and sit down on my feet. And that's her way of saying, we're not moving. And for me, I would just assume that it's because it's a busy environment. She's waiting for people to move out of the way, or maybe settle herself down, find her route, because it was very early on our partnership that she was doing this. And it was only when someone came over to me and said, are you okay? And I said, oh yes, I'm just waiting for my guide dog to get her bearings. And this lady said to me, did you not know this, but your dog actually got hit by an umbrella. She got swiped across the face, and that's why she sat on your feet. And I kind of went home and I said to my wife, wouldn't it be great to just have a Kika eye view? Wouldn't it be great? Because if you're in a busy environment, Kika sees the back of your legs. That's it. She doesn't see the sign. She doesn't know which tunnel she's going down, but yet she gets me to A to B every single time. I said, wouldn't it be fantastic to actually show people what Kika sees, and maybe they would appreciate giving guide dog owners or white cane owners, you know, just a little bit of space just to help navigate themselves around. The day we put the camera on her, we actually got three people pushing Kika out the way. We got footage of people trying to beat her to an escalator, and just before she jumps onto the escalator, people would push her and barge her out the way. And I thought, do you know what? This is not acceptable. This is not acceptable. So we were very reluctant at first to put anything out on social media, because with social media, it kind of goes two ways. You don't want to be that angry, disabled person, but then you kind of want to show the world, this is what you have to cope with every single day. And just maybe look up, look around you, just appreciate that it might take an extra 10 seconds for you to get off the escalator, but there's someone who's doing this as a blind person and still doing the same commute you do without the use of any useful vision. When we did put it out there, people were shocked, but that didn't stop people from still doing it. So it's an ongoing thing. The amount of times we get pushed and shoved on an escalator, I would say on average, it's about 3-4 times a week. The comments, you should use the stairs. Well, why don't you use the stairs? Yeah. It's as simple as that. Or you've made me miss my train. Well, leave a little bit earlier. Yeah. Put a buffer in there. I do it. Why can't you do it? It's very, very simple. But for every one person who's horrible, there's a million good people out there. And there's so many people who want to help.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, it is one of the great pleasures of being blind, is that you have conversations with people who you would never otherwise have met, and you realise how wonderful and open-hearted 99 out of 100 people are. However, I first came across your video of the irate commuter on the escalator 2 days after somebody had told me that I shouldn't be using the underground because I was blind, and I'd spent 48 hours feeling angry and unable to do anything about it. And then I saw your video, and I just thought, I'm not alone. And I think an awful lot of people who've lost their sight feel incredibly grateful that you've actually been brave enough to stand up and say, hang on, this isn't acceptable. This is going on. It's minority, but it's not just you or me that it's happening to. It's all of us.
Yeah, no, when I lost my sight, I lost who I was. I lost my confidence, my independence. I lost Amit. But my wife still believed that deep down, I was still there. She needed to help me kind of get my independence, my confidence back, and slowly, slowly, I will adapt to living with blindness. And I'm a lucky one. I've got an amazing wife. I've met some amazing people along my sight loss journey who have given me the motivation, that inspiration, just that pep talk that I needed sometimes, because sometimes you feel like you're going through this by yourself, but you're not. And I found it really patronizing when you get sighted people say, oh, I can imagine what you're going through. And you go, well, can you? Do you wake up in the morning? If you can't see anything at all, your life adapts slowly, you know, but you get there. You know what you're doing. You get your independence back. You get that confidence back. You get a zest for life back. And I got to that point where I was independent. I was out. I was working. And I genuinely had that smile on my face. But when you hear people say to you, well, let go of the escalator so I can get past because my life is worth more than yours is and I've got to be there at a certain time, or you get people who say to you, well, you shouldn't ride the trains, you're disabled, you should sit at home all day long. And when you think people actually think like that, that's when I kind of have to think, well, no, we stand together. It doesn't matter what disability you have. People should appreciate that you just have to be patient. And it's that, if it happened to you, what would you do? But even on the way here this morning, it's a route I've never taken before. So we've had to tackle the shared space, which I hate, which I'm a big campaigner about. We got to a junction and I wasn't quite sure where the traffic was coming from. But within seconds of getting to that junction, a gentleman came over to me and said, "How can I assist you?" And that just took all of that pressure away. Yeah. It's small things. It's tiny things. It's, you know, I don't expect anybody to do anything for me. I like to do it for myself. But sometimes you need that little bit of help.
That little bit of humanity just is a spark that will keep you warm for the rest of the day,
yes.
Isn't it? The book is called Kika and Me, and she's very patient. She's underneath the studio desk. Listeners might be able to hear her shaking her head from time to time, hopefully not disagreeing with me. How did your beautiful Golden Labrador?
Yeah, Golden Labrador.
Come into your life?
When I lost my sight, I don't think I ever thought about guide dogs. It was never a conversation me and my wife ever had. It was brought up by my mobility instructor a couple of times, and it was something we dismissed very early on because I could barely look after myself, let alone a dog. And I had nothing against dogs. I love dogs, but it's that whole, well, I'm trying to get myself back on my feet again. The last thing I want to think about is the guide dog. And it must have been about 2-3 years after my sight loss that the conversation was brought up again. And still we had doubts about guide dogs because in the back of my mind there was always, could I trust the dog? If a squirrel ran past or a cat ran past, would it chase after the squirrel or cat? And I always had that niggle in the back of my head, so I was never really comfortable. It was when I first met Dave Kent that it all kind of changed, because I met him in the London office and he turned to my wife and he said, "Seema, how are you doing? Don't worry about Amit, we will look after him." And that was the first time someone actually asked my wife how she was doing over me. Because sight loss, it didn't just affect me, it affected my wife too. But he understood that. And I thought to myself, this is a guy I need in my life. And it was just from conversation to conversation and actually talking about what these amazing dogs do that we decided it could be something for us. So we went down the whole processing where they come, they invade your life for a while, they see what you do, where you work, how fast you walk. I remember when they were actually following me while I was using my white cane, and it's like having a driving lesson. Mm. So you know the instructor's watching you, so you're overcompensating on everything. And they're like, "Amit, slow down, Amit, just don't wave your cane so much, you're knocking people over," kind of thing, and you can get back focused again. But by the end of the 3 months assessment, we were told, yeah, we think a dog will definitely enhance your life. So you're on the waiting list, and there's a 2.5-3 year waiting list at the time, because every guide dog is matched to the recipient depending on what they need the dog for. So we thought, right, we've got 2.5-3 years, and we got the call in 6 weeks.
Wow.
6 weeks. So I don't think it really sunk in. And the amazing thing is that I got the phone call saying, "We think we found you a dog, which is perfect, but she may not like you." So Kika has this thing where she either does like you or she doesn't. She was the most difficult dog through training. She did what she wanted to do. And we were also told that she needed to be stimulated all the time. She needs to be working. She's not one to sit in an office all day. Mm. She doesn't like the same routine every day. She needed to be out and about. And that's what I did. I was never in one place all the time. I was always out and about different places. But ever since we got matched up, the strength has got bigger and better and stronger. And now she takes me around the world for work.
And I believe there was a specific moment early on when you had her where actually that trust just clicked.
So for our training, we were actually put in a hotel for 10 days. So it's a new environment for me, new environment for Kika. So we both had to work together. For the first 2 days in our training, we were just in the corridors in this hotel. And I would give her the command, but I would pull back on the harness slightly. I would sense that we're coming up to some stairs, even though it wasn't any stairs. It was a new environment for me. But I still didn't have the trust in Kika. And Becca, my instructor, was telling me, "Amit, you need to let Kika work." And I said to her, "I feel I'm not sure if I can. I'm not sure I can trust the dog to keep me safe. I just didn't have that faith." And she was an 18-month-old tiny little puppy who refused to get into harness, would you believe? The first time I tried to put the harness on, she was on the floor, all fours, legs out, just, "No, I'm not doing this." And I thought, oh, do you know what? She doesn't want to work. I'm not sure if I can trust her. And it was the third night, it was the third morning actually, I woke up. I've got my hands against the walls, tracking for the bathroom in the hotel room. I get to the bathroom door and I found Kika standing in front. So I said, "Kika, move out of the way, Kika, move out of the way." She's having, "Nope, I'm not moving, I'm not budging." So I called Becca, the instructor, quite early on in the morning. And I say, Becca, am I doing something wrong? Kika's not listening to me. She won't let me use the bathroom. And Becca's like, Amit, you're bigger than her. Just pick her up and lift her out of the way. Just tell her who's boss. And I was still really reluctant because I wasn't sure what her temperament was. It's still very, very new to me. Never had a dog before either. So I wasn't sure how far to push this. So eventually I did manage to pull her out the way. I opened the bathroom door and a pipe had actually burst overnight and the bathroom was flooded. And it was a marble floor as well. So what I would have done is just open the door and walk straight in because there were no handrails or anything to hold onto when you go into the bathroom. And I thought, do you know what? She only knows me for a few days. Yet she stopped me from actually walking into the bathroom. That morning, I actually let go of all my fears and let Kika do what she does. And she even let me put on the harness without falling on the floor. I think that's when she actually knew that I trust her now. And that was definitely a turning point for us. And ever since then, it's just got stronger and stronger.
And it's been quite a journey.
It has been a journey. The adventures we've got into, the problem she's got me out of, just is amazing. So just after we got Kika, we had actually planned to go away to Amsterdam with my father-in-law. It was his 60th birthday. But I just got Kika and it wasn't practical for me to go or leave her anywhere. So the rest of the family all went. So I was left home alone with Kika and we decided we'll take a little bit of a walk. We're walking down and she suddenly stops. She sits on my feet. And I'm giving her the command, forwards, forwards. We're near a busy road and it's raining. It's not a really nice day, but we're out and she's not moving at all. She's absolutely stuck on my feet. This is on a Saturday. I call guide dogs and I say, I'm trying to give these commands to Kika. She's not moving. What do I do? They're like, well, we don't know what we can do, Amit. If Kika doesn't want to move, I'm not sure. Is anybody else around who can help you? I'm calling out. There's nobody around, but I can hear cars driving down the road. So I said, okay, let me call the police. So I called the police. And I said, I'm a guide dog owner. I think I'm about here. I can't be sure, but my guide dog refuses to move. Can you send someone out? So I was on the phone to the operator for about 10 minutes while a patrol car came to find me. And what they told me is we'd actually walked past some construction. And due to the rain, there was bollards that had fallen in front of us and bollards had fallen behind us. And we were on a dual carriageway. And there was no safe passage around. So that's why Kika stopped. It was a trip in a police car back home. But the great thing is I did call my wife. Going home in the police car and say, you just left a few hours ago. Guess where we are? Which didn't go down too well.
And Kika is very much part of the family, isn't she? I believe she was at the birth of one of your daughters.
She was there for both births. So being a dad, so Kika came first. I think she was the practice of having kids. You wake up, the first thing you think about is Kika. The last thing you think about is Kika. Whatever you do, you think about Kika. So my mindset now is very much Kika, Kika, Kika. And then we found out we were expecting. And I think that was probably one of the hardest things to accept because I thought, how am I going to be a blind dad? I'm going to miss out on so much. And my wife said to me, she sat me down and said, Amit, you're not going to miss out on anything. You can do everything. We just have to do it differently. And I thought, you know what? If I'm going to be a dad, I'm going to be the best dad I can. So we were there through all the appointments. The first time Kika heard the heartbeat of my son, her ears pricked up and she laid her head on my wife's tummy just to say, I'm looking after you now. And she was there throughout all the appointments. And the day my son was born, she was in the room with us, which was amazing. When my daughter was born 7 months ago, it was so quick from my wife going into labor that we had no choice but to bring my son with us as well. So my son was in the room. Kika was in the room. Kika kept my son calm and relaxed. And yeah, it was an experience.
The other side of your life, apart from being a very busy dad, is your campaigning and your diversity and inclusion consultancy.
Yeah, so after my sight loss, it was very much, what do I do? I can't really practice as a doctor and I don't want to be behind the scenes. I'm someone who can't sit behind the desk for too long. I need to be doing something. So through the whole sight loss journey, we found that it's a lottery to where you live, to what you get service-wise. I was very lucky that I got white cane training. I got braille lessons. I didn't have to wait long. You hear stories that people are waiting a year or over a year for white cane lesson. And when they do get a white cane lesson, it'll be an hour in a park. And that's supposedly enough for you to actually go and navigate the world. So we started campaigning on things. If a local authority is responsible for this, they should provide the service. When you're on a tube or a train and you've got the turn up and go service where a member of staff will put you on a train and tell you that there'll be someone to get you off, that should happen every single time. There shouldn't be a reason why it shouldn't happen. So when it doesn't happen, we try and talk to either the company, the manufacturers, we talk to authorities. Nobody was really listening for the first couple of years. And then suddenly, I think people realise that, well, this does make sense. It affects so much more people. It's not just sight loss. It's people with any type of disabilities and the elderly as well. The great thing is that organisations then started coming to me. Amit, how can we make this better? Or we saw this video and actually we can improve our services. Or when TfL did their Turn Up and Go service, now I have an app within the organisation. I went to trial it. Does this work? And also talking to organisations, talking to companies, corporate events, where why don't you have disabled people working for you? The way I think about something is completely different to the way a sighted person thinks about something. Why wouldn't you want to tap into a different way of things and making it streamline?
It's problem solving.
It really is. I remember volunteering for Living with Sight Loss, and there was a gentleman who turned up every week. He was very, very angry, to the point where he would sit on his own, everybody else would avoid him. We're having coffee one morning, and I went over to him and I said, why are you angry? And everybody's like, oh my God, Amit's just said this. Oh, Amit, you're going to get hit now. And I said, why are you so angry? Tell me why you're so angry. And he said to me, he recently just lost his sight. He was in his 50s. And he said, every morning when he woke up, as a sighted person, he'll put toothpaste on his toothbrush and then brush his teeth. Now, as a visually impaired person, he tries to put toothpaste on his brush, but misses it every time. And it starts his day off in that really bad mood. And the rest of the day just gets worse and worse. And I said, how about if you just put a bit of paste on your finger, put it in your mouth, and then put your brush in? And because he was still thinking about doing things as a sighted person. Once you figure out how to do it as a visually impaired person, you don't think about it. It just happens. He came in the next week with chocolates and coffee and biscuits. And he was a different person. It was because you have to change your mindset. And sometimes being in a group with other people who are going through the same things, just a small conversation can change your life for the better.
Hopefully that message is going to get spread further and wider. The book is out this week. It's called Kika and Me, How One Extraordinary Guide Dog Changed My Life. Were you involved in it being recorded as an audiobook?
Yes, so the whole process of writing the book was probably more difficult than it needed to be. Assistive tech is fantastic. Assistive tech is fantastic when it works. You know, the amount of edits and the changes you have to do. And then I think I've sent it across to the editor. And then she's like, oh, you haven't done anything, Amit. And, you know, you kind of forget how it takes a little bit longer to do things. But I was very concerned about the audiobook. The audiobook was one thing that I wanted out on the same day as publication. Mm. There's a lot of publishing houses out there who don't do that as standard. They'll wait 6 months or 9 months or a year to release an audiobook. But, you know, imagine a blind guy writing a book and it not being accessible. So it was the forefront that when we do have this book out, that there's an audiobook to accompany it. So we had this amazing gentleman called Chetan Paduk, who is a newsreader for BBC. The moment I heard the prologue of the book is when I really thought, well, do you know what? This is it. This is the one thing I wanted to have that, you know, anybody could pick up and listen to, and it's my voice. But the great thing is for the RNIB library, I've actually done a little bit of talking myself, and there's a little bit of extra stuff in there in the contents, which I wanted to get across as well. But the lovely thing is, my wife actually wrote a chapter in the book, because people forget, sight loss, it wasn't just me, it was my family. Me and my wife, we just got married just before I lost my sight. So it's great to have her voice in there. And she sat down and she's read the chapter herself.
So, audiobook or braille book?
50-50. When I used to read as a sighted person, I love the pictures that I can actually build in my head. Sometimes I feel with an audiobook, they're kind of painted for me. It's like watching TV. It's already there. I like to get lost in a book, and I like to take it at my own pace. I'll go back a chapter and read it again because, oh, did I miss this? Did I miss this at all? And with an audiobook, it's kind of difficult to do that. But it depends where I am and what I'm doing. The only braille books I read at the moment is children's books. Anything from Peppa Pig to The Hungry Caterpillar to absolutely anything my son wants to read and we can get hold of in braille. But when you're relaxing, it's nice to just have an audiobook in the background.
What I love about the book is it's not just your story. You have two amazing supportive females in your life, your wife and Kika, and it's about you interacting as a blind person in a sighted world, and I think all of us have something to learn from it. It's a very thoughtful book. You've clearly mulled these questions over a long time in your head.
It's funny. It feels like I've lived with sight loss for such a long time, but in reality, it isn't that long. A lot of things have happened in such a short amount of time. I put that down to the people around me. I've always been a believer of communities. If there was a patient at hospital who didn't have anybody to come in and visit them or anything, after my shift, I'd go and spend 20 minutes, half an hour, having a conversation with someone, because I know what that means. I grew up in a town in Guildford where everybody knew everybody else. You say hello to people, you're kind, you're considerate, people are looking out for each other. And that has always been with me, and that's something my parents have installed in me and my brother. It's not about you, it's about the wider community. So when I lost my sight, I felt that I lost my community. I felt that I can't see my community and they're not there anymore. But they were. Every single person was there. And you don't want to admit that you're going through so much pain. Everybody else knows you're going through that, but you're trying to hide this, and you're wasting energy trying to hide this, which is the worst thing. Then you're tired all the time. It's a vicious circle. But it's the people around you. It's the people who just say, Amit, do you want a coffee? Let's just go here. Let's just do this. What do you want to do? You know, and just take my mind off things and not talk about sight loss. Not talk about, oh, how is your day going? Let's just talk about something completely different and take me away from the whole sight loss thing for even an hour. That's what it's all about. And I'm very lucky. I've got to work with some amazing communities. The Eden Project are one of the things that really, you know, stick with me. We walk from Morecambe in Lancashire down to London. We stopped at community projects along the way just to talk about what community means to people. And then we ended it with a street party in Hackney. And we had Joe Brand and Ainsley Harriott come along. I said to everybody, oh, I'm going to hold a street party in June in 2019. Not thinking that we'd ever have a kid, which the due date was about the same time. But I went and flyered about 500 houses in our area and just said, I'm having a party, turn up, bring a dish. And then the thing was, people would call me up and say, how much is this going to cost me? What's this in aid of? And I said, well, it's not in aid of anything. It's not going to cost you anything. Let's just get the community together. And the day of the street party, I said to my wife, if I open the door and there's nobody outside to help me put the bunting up, what am I going to do? She's heavily pregnant. We're like 2 weeks away from the due date. I open the door and there's five big burly guys outside going, right, Amit, how much bunting do we have to put up? In about a 200-yard space, we put up 3.5 miles of bunting. We closed the road off. We even featured in ITV News that evening because it was just insane. And the funny thing is, everybody said to me, so, Amit, how are we going to know when your daughter's born? And I said, well, when my daughter's born, I'll put a little bit of bunting outside my house. That'll be the indication that, you know, she's born. The morning she was born, I went home and the first thing I did is put bunting outside the house. And when I brought my wife home a day later, we were greeted to about 150 congratulation cards. These are 150 people more than we'd known 2 weeks ago. It's all about community.
It's a phenomenal story. I recommend Kika and Me to all our listeners. They'll all be able to find the enhanced audiobook version in the RNIB library from next week. Dr. Amit Patel, thank you so much for coming in and being a guest on Read On.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
The other unknown was how Kika would react to our new arrival. Would she feel threatened? How would she behave? All dogs are different, and even with her calm temperament, we couldn't really know how Kika might respond. That said, Kika had come with us to every single scan and hospital appointment. Her ears would prick up every time she heard the little heartbeat, and she'd always be by Seema's side during the scan. Throughout the spring and summer, whenever she wasn't at work with me, Kika stayed as close to Seema as she was able. As she followed Seema around the house, with her big doggy eyes full of adoration, it was hard to believe that she had ever been ambivalent towards my darling wife. Kika's devotion was complete. We were quietly hopeful that her feelings would extend to the baby when he or she finally arrived. The hospital was used to seeing Kika at antenatal appointments, but our biggest fear was how we could manage her while Seema was in labour. We had no idea how long labour would last. We could end up being in hospital for days, in which case, who would look after Kika? We'd never left Kika alone, and she'd never really been apart from both of us at the same time. She'd have to come with us.
Chetan Pathak, narrating Kika and Me, written by my guest, Dr. Amit Patel, which is out now in print and audio. And members of the RNIB Library can access the augmented talking book version featuring Amit via the rniblibrary.com website or by calling the helpline on 0303 123 9999. That number again, 0303 123 9999. Now, before Amit shares the books of his life, here's Robert with something that should appeal to Kika.
Some shaggy dog tales in the RNIB library. First up, Thunderdog by Michael Higson, read by Christopher Prince.
Thunderdog celebrates the power of the human and animal bond, and we all can learn life lessons from this incredible story.
When one of four hijacked planes flew into the World Trade Center's North Tower on September the 11th, 2001, Michael Higson, a district sales manager, was sitting down for a meeting. His guide dog, Roselle, was at his feet. Paired for 21 months, man and dog spent that time forging a bond of trust. Michael couldn't see a thing, but he could hear the sounds of shattering glass, falling debris, and terrified people flooding around him and Roselle. However, Roselle sat calmly beside him. In that moment, Michael chose to trust Roselle's judgment and not to panic. They were a team.
Our sky lobby seems safe for now, although a fire is raging somewhere above us. The copious amounts of thick black smoke are evidence of a fire fed by ample fuel, with flames burning at temperatures somewhere in the range of 1300 to 1400 degrees Fahrenheit. We still don't know what has caused the fire or even the initial impact and explosion, but the adrenaline-charged voices around us speed up my steps. The closest stairwell to us is stairwell B. It's right in the center of the lobby, between the local elevators, the smaller ones that access the upper floors. Roselle stops at the door to the stairwell, just as she always does. She positions her body to the left of the door, so I can reach out and open it. Six or seven people surround us in a loose group, and taking turns, David, Roselle, and I enter the stairwell. Roselle pauses at the top of the stairs. Through the harness, I can feel her look up at me for direction. She is calm, standing quietly. I wonder what she's thinking. Forward, I say with confidence. But my mind immediately begins to wander. What are we getting ourselves into? How many people are already in this stairwell trying to leave at the same time? How long is it going to take us to get out? My right hand clutches the rail attached to the wall, while my left hand grips Roselle's leather leash and the leather-covered handle on her guide dog harness. She can relax a bit now. Her job at this point is to watch the people around us and alert me to any hazards, both below and above. Her brow furrows a bit as her face takes on a look of intense concentration. She stands up straighter, tail erect, and her muscles tense, as her movements become controlled and purposeful. Her senses go on high alert, and if she had antennae, they would be up. Roselle is ready to go wherever I command her to go. She is ready to work.
Thunderdog by Michael Higson is read by Christopher Prince. Next up, Finding Harmony, the remarkable dog that helped a family through the darkest of times. Written by Sally Hyder and read by Carolyn Bonneman.
There are lots of reasons why dogs won't work for you. Too tired, hungry, hot, bored. But there are two reasons why they want to do so. Rewards and fun.
A keen mountaineer, Sally Hyder was in her prime and loving life. She shared her passion for climbing with her partner Andrew, and it was a dream come true when he proposed at Everest Base Camp. But a year after Sally and Andrew were married, Sally was diagnosed with MS. It was when her youngest child, Melissa, was diagnosed with severe autism that Sally began to spiral into depression. Sally felt guilty about the pressures faced by her elder daughter, Clara, in her role as carer. But she happened upon canine partners and an extraordinary dog called Harmony, with whom she formed an instant bond. Before a short clip of the book, here's Sally herself.
Harmony came into our lives and it's just been one big adventure. I had the excitement of meeting her and then training with her and then bringing her home and then seeing her wonderful behaviour with Melissa particularly and how she helps Melissa with all of her panics. We haven't had any screaming since she came home. So it's just been very, very helpful. There is the day-to-day tasks that she helps me with that have made a huge difference, emptying my washing machine, taking my socks off, taking the Velcro off my boots and helping me pull them off, you name it. And that saves energy. We have a tidy up time in the morning when I say tidy up, and she gives me a basket that I put on my lap, and then she picks all the things that have been left on the floor. And it means that my older daughter doesn't come home from school and have to tidy things up and help me get undressed or dressed in the evenings. And so I'm back to being a mum, which I don't think my teenagers are too impressed by, I have to say.
Sally Hyder talking about her book, Finding Harmony. The audiobook is read by Carolyn Borryman with an introduction by Sally Hyder.
MS is progressive. I'm marking the deterioration weekly, which means that I'm keen to do as much as I can now. Last summer we went sailing at the Culvert Trust at Kielder. It has a huge forest and the biggest man-made lake in Europe. I sailed by myself for 3 hours in a specially adapted sailing boat. The others were water skiing. Oh, the glory of rushing along on the waves, feeling the wind in my hair, the sun on my face, and doing it all by myself. Indeed, my mum tells me that my most oft-repeated phrase as a toddler was, "I do it myself." But there was a penalty. As soon as my feet touched the ground, I was subjected to all-over body licking from Harmony as she checked me over. It was as if she was grumbling, "How on earth am I supposed to look after you if you go off and do stupid things like sailing by yourself?" As I've become more adventurous, her grumbles have got more vocal. The family find this hilarious.
Next, Nigel, My Family and Other Dogs, written and read by Monty Dawn.
Right from the beginning, Nigel has been different. It helps that he's good-looking, beautiful even, but so are lots of dogs. And anyway, as we do our children, we all think our dogs are fine creatures.
When Monty Dawn's golden retriever Nigel became the surprise star of BBC Gardener's World, inspiring huge interest, fan mail, and even his own social media accounts, Monty Dawn wanted to explore what makes us connect with animals quite so deeply. In many respects, Nigel is a very ordinary dog, charming, handsome, and obedient, as so many are. He is a much-loved family pet. He's also a star. By telling Nigel's story, Monty relates his relationships with other special dogs in his life in a memoir of his dog's past and very much present.
Nigel has that very rare quality of drawing attention to him as if by osmosis. He steals every scene he's in. He takes the light from a room and casts it so that it falls on him to his very best advantage. When we're filming, it's uncanny how he will always find just the one position where the combination of sunlight, flowers, the whole composition of the scene, about which he can't possibly have the slightest notion, all come together to work perfectly around him.
And finally, My Life in His Paws, the story of Ted and How He Saved Me by Wendy Hilling. It's read by Carol Ann Lime.
"You mean your dog just saved your life?" "Oh yes," I say. "He does it all the time." I reach down and stroke Ted's head. I couldn't live without him. Ted's been the making of me.
Wendy Hilling has a rare skin condition, which means her skin is very delicate. Every moment is difficult and causes pain. It affects the body inside and out. Her throat is very narrow and she can stop breathing at any time. But 8 years ago, Wendy's life changed forever. She met Ted, a golden retriever, and he became her full-time carer. He has saved her life more times than she can remember, always watching and listening, and she is now entirely reliant on him.
"I wake up and I can't breathe or move. My throat is contracting and I can't shout for help. My husband is lying next to me and my dog, Ted, lies at the foot of the bed. They are both asleep, and I can't move to wake them. I'm scared witless. They say your life flashes before your eyes when you're about to die, and it's true. I know this is desperate. I don't have much time left." In an instant, Ted is on his feet. He rushes over to the panic button on our bedroom wall and presses it with his nose. When the operator answers, Ted is barking so she knows he's there. She expects him now. Hello, Ted. Tell Mummy and Daddy there's an ambulance on its way. He rushes round to Peter's side of the bed and pulls at his pillow and barks to make sure he's awake. Peter turns me on my side, and after a time I can breathe again. The relief is intense. By the time the ambulance arrives, I'm breathing normally and starting to recover, but we are both shocked. One of the paramedics tests my oxygen levels. It's a good thing your husband called us so quickly, he says. Even if he can get you breathing again, we need to check there hasn't been lasting damage. Seconds count when you can't breathe. Oh, it wasn't my husband who called you, I say. It was the dog.
My Life in His Paws, the story of Ted and How He Saved Me by Wendy Hilling, is read by Carol Ann Lyne. For more information on these or the many, many other Shaggy Dog tales in the RNIB Talking Books Library, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. The library is completely free for anyone in the UK with a print disability. That number again is 0303 123 9999.
Now, let's return to Dr. Amit Patel for the books of his life. Was there a book that, as a child or a young man, made you fall in love with reading?
It was the books from Roald Dahl. It was the collection of books from Roald Dahl. They were the ones that I would be immersed as one of the characters in the book. And I would put this down to my teachers. When I was at primary school, my teachers were a fan of books. When we had story times, it would be something special. We would read a chapter each, we would do it in our own voices, and they would also let us kind of add on bits that we think have been missed out in the book, which is what I like. I like to read something and think, oh, this would have been better if the character had been this way round, or, you know. And that's always stayed with me. It's that whole creativeness. I never pick up a book and just read it. I kind of want to get in there. I want to jump into the book and be part of the book.
Here is James Henry Trotter when he was about 4 years old. Then there's a picture of a very happy little boy. Up until this time, he had had a happy life, living peacefully with his mother and father in a beautiful house beside the sea. There were always plenty of other children for him to play with, and there was the sandy beach for him to run about on, and the ocean to paddle in. It was the perfect life for a small boy. Then one day, James's mother and father went to London to do some shopping, and there a terrible thing happened. Both of them suddenly got eaten up, in full daylight, mind you, and on a crowded street, by an enormous angry rhinoceros which had escaped from the London Zoo.
There's a large selection of books by Roald Dahl in the RNIB library in a range of accessible formats, including this version of James and the Giant Peach, narrated by Roald Dahl himself, which is TB6212. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
I love reading about people. I love reading about how people have got to where they are now. Nelson Mandela, his journey, just what he's gone through, his way of seeing the world. It's these kind of people that I've always been attracted to. It's pushing the boundaries. Even as a young boy, when people say, you can't do this, that was a trigger for me to say, right, well, I can. Why can't I do this? And even now, my collection of books, I love the history. I love the way people think about things. So reading these memoirs, you actually get to know the person. You actually, the thinking behind the process, that's the things that kind of get to me. That's the things that really intrigue me. I don't want a storyline I kind of know the answer to. I kind of want to know a little bit more.
During those first few months, breakfast was delivered to us in our cells by prisoners from the general section. Breakfast consisted of mealy-pup porridge, cereal made from maize or corn, which the general prisoners would slop in a bowl and then spin through the bars of our cells. It was a clever trick and required a deft hand so as not to spill any of the porridge. After a few months, breakfast was delivered to us in the courtyard in old metal drums. We would help ourselves to pup using simple metal bowls. We each received a mug of what was described as coffee, but was in fact ground-up maize baked until it was black and then brewed with hot water. Later, when we were able to go into the courtyard to serve ourselves, I would go out there and jog around the perimeter until breakfast arrived. Like everything else in prison, diet is discriminatory. In general, coloureds and Indians received a slightly better diet than Africans, but it was not much of a distinction. The authorities liked to say that we received a balanced diet. It was indeed balanced, between the unpalatable and the inedible. Food was the source of many of our protests, but in those early days the warders would say, "Ach, you Kaffirs are eating better in prison than you ever ate at home."
Long Walk to Freedom, the autobiography of Nelson Mandela, is TB10472. It's narrated by Jonathan Cartwright. And finally, is there a book you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
I've actually been very lucky to have a book sent to me called Can You Hear Me? It's a book written by a paramedic and his 10-year experience of what he's gone through, what he's seen. It's nice to kind of get lost in that medical world. It takes me back. I think reading books that relate to me, I can be a paramedic in that story. It sets off these fireworks in my head because it takes me back. And I kind of remember the days when I was there. So it's very, very real for me.
It's there as soon as the door opens. Sour, sweet, stale. It surges down the corridor in search of the outside world. It burns the nostrils and sits like a powder at the back of the throat. Small breaths, small breaths. 74-year-old female, collapsed, not alert. No one is ever alert. This is a truism of telephone triage. Even when they've made the call themselves, no one is ever alert. We approach the flat. Flies dance in the doorway. The odour thickens, expands, envelops us. It has layers. It has texture. It's a physical thing, a presence, a force field, a chemical weapon.
Can You Hear Me? A Paramedic's Encounters with Life and Death by Jake Jones is out now as a commercial audiobook, narrated by Elliot Fitzpatrick. Dr. Amit Patel and Kika, who has been incredibly well-behaved underneath the desk here, thank you so much for coming into the RNIB Connect radio studio, and very best of luck with the book and all the campaigning.
Thank you so much.
Remember, you can share the books of your life by emailing us. The address is radio@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for today, but we'll be back at the same time next week. We're also available as a podcast. Just search your provider for Read On, the audiobook show, to subscribe, rate, or leave a review. And why not follow us on Twitter? I'm @RedSail, which is REDSZELL, and producer Robert is @Talking_Books. Farewell until next week and the next chapter of Read On.